Thanks for joining us. I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recovering from a voice treatment. Former President Jimmy Carter was to have been our guest today. However, his trip to Washington was cancelled after he became ill yesterday. We wish him good health. We're happy instead to have with us the author of the first authorised history of MI6. Keith Jeffrey is a professor of British history at Queen's University Belfast. He was granted access to documents never before seen by anyone outside Britain's Secret Intelligence Service. They reveal the true story of the heroes, the villains, and the techniques featured in thousands of novels and films. The book is The Secret History of MI6, 1909 to 1949. Keith Jeffrey joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jeffrey.
Delighted to be here.
We will be opening the phones. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. Our email address is drshow@wamnu.org. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook, which I suspect they didn't have in MI6 in the early part of the last century.
I'm not sure they have it now. They wouldn't admit to it anyway.
Oh, I'm sure even they do. When we think of MI6, I think that everybody in this country certainly immediately thinks of one James Bond, and that's probably pretty much it.
Yes, absolutely. James Bond is the most famous single fictional spy in the world, and in his novels, he works for MI6. So it's a strong brand name, but I'm not sure that the reality is necessarily precisely the same as it is in the books and the films. I think, actually, the reality is better.
Better how? Because it's more exciting?
Better because it's real people. It's not some cartoon character with a get-out-of-jail-free card or a get-out-of-gizmo-free card kind of thing. And although the novels in some ways portrayed as a more nuanced kind of person, and some of the more recent movies, certainly Casino Royale, suggested human weaknesses as well as strengths, in the end, Bond is fiction. In the end, Fleming made it up. And that's something that I, as a historian, can't do. What you get is the real deal in this book, or as real as I can possibly make it.
Well, you were given access to thousands of files by MI6. How much did they let you see, and why did they let you see it?
Well, they let me see it because I'm the best, and I'm more trusted than anything else. One of the problems of this engagement is that they, having decided to commission a history because of their centenary, having been founded in 1909, successful organisation, you know, likes to have its history written. They quite bravely, I think, from their point of view, and I'm delighted to be able to help with this, decided to commission it from an independent historian. And that's one problem, because although I've been selected through a perfectly, you know, reasonable selection process, people were sounded out who knew something about the field. My expertise lies in military and some intelligence history in the first half of the 20th century, so I was one of the people who knew something about it. I had to submit written work to a committee. I was interviewed. I wasn't the only person interviewed. So the process was comparatively straightforward, like applying for any job. The difference between this and any other job was, of course, the sensational, as it were, nature of the project, writing history at all. I mean, that's the big sort of surprise. And secondly, of course, this extraordinary offer for access to the holy grail of British archives. The SIS archive, the MI6 archive, is the one government departmental archive in Britain that is not open at all. And they don't consider, and they have no plans, and they certainly don't deliver any of their documents to the National Archives.
So
access to that is just extraordinary.
Was the picture of MI6 that you drew from access to those archives, and from when it was founded back in 1909 all the way up through to the end of the Second World War, was it a very different organisation from the one that much of the public might imagine?
Well, by the end of my 40 years, it has become a recognisably modern organisation. It begins in a very ad hoc way. There are worries in 1909 about the threat from Germany in particular. And that, those worries focus in on two levels. One is that Britain might be swarming, there might be German spies swarming all over Britain. Curiously, they worry about German waiters in restaurants and German hairdressers, which was a bit of a surprise to me that there are teams of German hairdressers, but running sort of hair salons and garrison towns and quizzing soldiers and that sort of thing. The other worry was that Germany was building up its navy. It was beginning to rival Britain in Europe and across the world. And they worried about a surprise attack from Germany, a bolt from the blue across the North Sea. And so they needed to know about German capabilities and German intentions. And in 1909, they set up a Secret Service Bureau with a Home Department, which turns into MI5, the Domestic Security Agency, roughly comparable to the FBI in the United States, and a Foreign Department, which turns into MI6, which is the one I'm concerned with, and roughly equivalent to the CIA. And so this begins to systematise the thing. But it's a one man in an office sitting on his own right at the beginning. By 1949, it's professional, it's valued, it's a permanent part of the British governmental structure. It's, you know, recognisably what it becomes in the later Cold War years and indeed up to the present.
Your book does not cover the Cold War period. Why not?
Well, it covers the beginning of the Cold War period, but the decision was made right from the beginning that the terminal date would be 1949, which is a sort of first 40 years is fine. It takes you into, as I say, to the first few years of the Cold War. Now, I fell on my knees every night and thanked the Lord I wasn't going beyond 49, because it was quite difficult to fit in a single volume. That was another part of the brief. A single volume, the extraordinary full history that I wanted to write. But because of the sorts of things that MI6 do, which is so sensitive, it inevitably breaks laws. Now, it doesn't, I hope, break British laws, but it inevitably breaks foreign laws. And by only going to 49, by stopping 60 years ago, it seems a long time, it isn't necessarily so, by stopping 60 years ago, it means that I could tell as much more fuller story and as full as really possible up to that moment. Once you move into the 50s and the 60s, you've got these long-running Cold War operations, which might indeed run right through to the end of the Cold War, and that's another 40 years. That might take you to 1989, and that really is the day before yesterday.
So you're suggesting that MI6 might have found that period too sensitive to reveal quite yet?
Well, yes. I mean, I think sensitive for good kind of security reasons. Sensitive too, because they were successes and failures as well in those years. But they allowed me, and after some discussions, to discuss the failures as well as the successes. And it was always intended to be a kind of warts and all history. So it's quite an interesting engagement, because one measure of how successful and resilient an organisation is how it deals with failure. And I think that, so it's worth sort of pausing on those as well. Now, there would be people in the organisation might say, I don't want to talk about, failures in the 50s, 60s, 70s, if they exist. Again, stopping in 49 meant that the whole range of experience and the history of the organisation could, as I say, be more thoroughly investigated.
We mentioned Ian Fleming, but you write in the book that there was a much wider connection between MI6 and novelists.
Indeed. I sometimes wonder whether the capacity for making things up, which novelists, of course, have to do and elegantly to present them and seamlessly to write their narratives, may make them good intelligence officers. I'm not absolutely sure, because you need to not to make it up too much as well.
And I'm not sure novelists are very good at keeping secrets.
No, exactly. And some of them, of course, told their secrets. Somerset Maugham, who appears in the book, worked in the First World War as an intelligence agent, both for MI6, or its forerunner, and other organisations. And he wrote a series of short stories called the Ashendon Stories, which recounted his experience of this. Compton Mackenzie, another novelist, wrote his memoirs in the 1930s and got into terrific trouble with the organisation because he was prosecuted for revealing such terrible secrets as the first chief of the organisation was known by the single letter C, root and green ink, and he also alleged that he'd cut off his own leg with a penknife, which I think is more a part of the mythological way that stories grow than not, and maybe that reflected his novelist's take on history rather than a careful intelligence report.
And then you also, of course, have Ian Fleming, who we mentioned earlier in the programme, and James Bond was in MI6. You suggest in this book that he was based on a real person.
Well, not precisely based on a real person, but you find people who fit some of the James Bond models here. And one of these is Wilfred Biffy Dunderdale.
Fabulous name.
Well, of course, it's a gift. The name's Dunderdale, Biffy Dunderdale. Well, it perhaps doesn't have quite the same ring. Though he did, in November 1940, go to Lisbon on a false passport to meet some of his old contacts from the Vichy French Intelligence Service, or who had then become that. And he took his passport, and there's a picture of the passport and of Biffy, who you can see is a glamorous man in the book, under the name John Green.
Okay, in good Ian Fleming style, just to keep our listeners hanging on to this gripping spy story, we now have to take a break, but I want to come back to Biffy Dunderdale and the rest of MI6 after this quick break. We are listening to Keith Jeffrey talking about his book, The Secret History of MI6, 1909 to 1949. We'll be opening the phones later on in the programme. Stay with us for the next instalment. Welcome back. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking to Keith Jeffrey. He is the author of The Secret History of MI6, 1909 to 1949, before our break. Biffy Dunderdale had hopped off to Lisbon on a false passport. He has echoes of James Bond, Keith. How?
Yes, indeed. Dunderdale has an interesting background, interesting provenance. He comes from a family, a British family, who had settled in Russia working as marine architects, marine engineers in Odessa, in the port of Odessa on the Black Sea. And in fact, a very important source of recruits for the British Secret Service were these products of the what you might call the English or British commercial diaspora of the late 19th and early 20th century. Biffy is brought up, he's called Biffy, by the way, because he, or apparently so, because he was a celebrated amateur boxer and used to biff people, which is, I suppose, a good thing to do if you're an amateur boxer. And but anyway, he joined the service in 1919. He was educated and brought up in Russia. He spoke Russian like a native. Now, here's one of the differences between the real James Bond, the real spy, and James Bond. Bond, in the books or the movies, doesn't seem to have much of a facility for foreign languages, but you may be sure that the real operatives and officers It's a very desirable requirement. And Dunderdale has this fluent Russian. At a time in 1919 when increasingly the intelligence focus has been placed on the newly founded Soviet Union, he rises in the ranks and by the early 1930s becomes head of station in Paris, absolutely crucial posting, and not just because spying against the French, there's not very much of that, there's a little bit of that. What he mostly does is liaison with the French, but there are lots of white Russians and other nationalities swimming around in Paris, and it's a good place to pick up stuff, agents and information. He has a penchant for pretty women and fast cars. He's a very glamorous man. He's a big man, but light on his feet, as perhaps his boxing success suggested. And one of the key things he does as the head of station is he builds up this very trusting and important liaison relationship with the French. And that pays off in unexpected ways, because the French are working very hard on signals intelligence, on trying to crack the keys of the German Enigma machine. And they have a human agent in the German intelligence who gives them early vital information about the German Enigma machine, which is an enciphering machine. The Poles, too, who are close friends with the French, and through the French with Biffy, also are working on the Enigma machine. And they bring this material to Britain in 1939 and 1940. And it provides one of the crucial early keys for cracking the Enigma code and all those chaps in Bletchley Park, which was under MI6, who provide this fantastic intelligence. So what Dunderdale does is not so much slope about shooting people and you know, doing these dramatic with one leap he's free kind of stuff and having all these amazing sort of gizmos. What Dunderdale does with great charm and great perception and great expertise is to cultivate human relationships and human sources, and they pay off remarkably.
Indeed,
in the Second World War.
You write that he didn't have a license to kill, that this was a myth of MI6 agents.
Yes, I mean, I looked very hard for fatalities in the you know, directed kind of assassination, targeted assassinations, because that's what you expect to find. And although there's plenty of death, there are plenty of people who suffer with their lives for it, there's very little of the other. And there were two or three close occasions where examples of this, certainly in the Second World War, which I look at in some detail. But there's a scheme just before D-Day, which is raised as a possibility to have a systematic assassination campaign of German functionaries who are running things like transport and various communications infrastructure networks in France before D-Day. And if we have this coordinated assassination campaign, it will paralyze, you know, the whole German response to the invasion. And it goes to SIS and MI6, and they say, what can you do to help? Now, in a way, it should have gone to SOE, who are the Special Operations Organisation, but it goes to SIS, and Mingy's, the head of SIS, says, yes, we can produce a list of names, and we can probably help with this, but we need to think a little bit more carefully about whether it's useful or not, or whether it is. And the response comes back about assassination on a number of levels. One thing that's observed is, if it was so easy, people would be doing it all the time. A second problem was, when you run assassinations, you make mistakes. Inevitably, some of the wrong people are going to be killed, and you're going to have to live with that. A third problem is, we know from the Germans that if we start assassinating them, we knew from the assassination of Heydrich in Czechoslovakia a year or two before, that they wreak terrible, terrible reprisals against this. So it's going to be costly, and it's going to be costly on civilian grounds.
Go ahead.
No, right, just there is a final, and it's a very, very interesting reason. This is 1944, and they say, we're going to win the war. Actually, you know, now, we know we're going to win the war. We will have quasi-military, quasi-civilian officers in charge in Germany after the war. And if we start assassinating them now, they're Germans, our men in their turn will be targets for their assassins.
Keith, all of that is very interesting, and I wonder whether it has implications for today's MI6 or today's CIA?
Well, I'm sure it does. Now, I'm not in a position to report on the current activities. Part of the deal about going to 1949 and having absolutely free run up to there is that there's a kind of Chinese wall and I know nothing.
But certainly the kinds of objections that were raised to assassination campaigns that you talk about before the Second World War are the similar kinds of objections that you hear from intelligence officers today. It's interesting that the arguments are similar. Yeah.
Well, I would hope there were, on the grounds that, you know, it just isn't as straightforward as that. It's a bit like, we had this in Northern Ireland, sure, the notion that you'd send in some special operations, you know, the SAS or someone, and they would surgically, this is the kind of cancer metaphor, surgically cut out targeted assassination, and this will, you know, cut out the cancer and you'll be all right. Now, if you want to follow that cancer metaphor, in fact, cancer is not always most readily treated by radical surgical measures, and sometimes it makes it worse. There was an interesting comment in 44 when they were talking about assassination from the chairman of the JIC, and he says, I'm not against killing Germans. I have a long list of Germans I would like to be killed, but actually it's not that straightforward. And all, at least on practical grounds, if not also moral grounds, and you'd hope there as well, is that people consider the consequences of actions of this sort, because sometimes the end doesn't always justify those particular means.
Your book covers two big periods of war, the First World War, of course, and the Second World War, when a lot of MI6's activity was focused on Germany and on the threat from that would have come to Britain from Europe. What do you think MI6's role was in shaping Europe in that period?
One of its most important roles, and I've already sort of touched upon that, are its relations with resistance movements and the governments in exile. What 6 and also SOE and the other assistance which London and Britain could offer to those occupied countries was a sense that the battle wasn't over, that the war was not lost, that there was more to be done and it was worth hanging on, the kind of thing that Churchill, of course, articulates so eloquently in his public speeches. But they're also able to do practical things that assist. They're able to give individuals in occupied Europe a role themselves in the war. Now, it's very hazardous. It can be very dangerous. You haven't got a kind of huge range of master spies, you know, men or women. What you've got are thousands upon thousands of individuals who are able to play their part, sometimes at a terrific risk to themselves, but it provided a kind of light, potential light at the end of the tunnel, and I think that was actually quite important.
Let's go to the phones now to Brendan in Washington, D.C. Brendan, you have a question for Keith Jeffrey.
Yes, I was curious. I know MI is probably Ministry of Information, but what is the significance of the number in the title of the department?
Ah, well, MI is military intelligence, in fact.
Okay.
And the significance of the number is that it has no significance. That's the point. In fact, in the First World War, there are a whole series of MIs. MI 1, 2, and 3 were geographical areas. North Europe, Mediterranean, rest of the world. MI 4 was the map department. MI 5 was the security department. MI 6 in the First World War was economic intelligence, which was quite important then. And so it went on. In the Second World War,
how many MIs were there, Keith?
Well, there were up to about 18 in the Second World War. And they were just sort of added to the list as you had something else. MI9 was escape lines. MI14 was German order of battle. And 6, by the Second World War, which is when the title was first used, is just simply an accommodation address. It's a post office box number. And it's meant to give these guys who are in uniform a little bit of cover. I'm working for MI6, I can't tell you what it is, but it kind of has an existence, sufficient existence to pass them off, but not to indicate precisely what they do.
It's not a totally glorious history, is it? There were times when MI6 was engaged in operations that went awry, if we can put it like that. Talk to me about Operation Embarrass.
Well, Embarrass might be regarded as a success, and was by some, but from our perspective, it looks literally embarrassing, and it was both literally and figurative an explosive story. The operation was MI5's, or MI6's, sorry, contribution towards preventing and impeding immigration of Jews to Palestine in 1947. Britain is the governing authority for Palestine. They have made immigration, they've limited the number of Jews who can go to the country, and they've done this from the 1930s in order to, you know, prevent the communal balance from breaking down. But in 47, you've got these desperate, thousands of desperate people trying to, having survived the disasters, the catastrophe of the Holocaust in the Second World War, desperate to get to some place of safety, in their case Israel, or Palestine, Israel was to become. But the British rule is we're limiting the numbers coming in, and there are various levels in which they can do it. They have a blockade on the coast, which the British Navy intercepts these ships, and they go to SIS and said, well, what with your covert kind of expertise, what can you do to help? And they come back with an extraordinary operation which on all levels sort of almost exactly fits the kind of spy novel that the amateur observer of this kind of area might want to find. You've got frogmen with limpet mines off ports in France and Italy, tasked to go in and disable the ships before the refugees arrive on them. And they're not sinking these ships at sea. They have specific instructions from the Foreign Office, who know about it. It has the highest political authority, that you're not to kill people to do this. But if you can blow the rudder off the ship while it's in harbour, then it'll never leave. They'll never get there. So that's a good one. They another part of it is trying to plant documents on the Russian intelligence services through a nightclub in Vienna, which we know they use. And the document was supposed to persuade the Russians, there's no evidence that this worked, but it was supposed to persuade the Russians that Jewish refugees coming out of Eastern Europe were a very, very important and significant source of intelligence to the British and the American intelligence organisations. So you rather hoped by persuading the Russians of this that they would stop the illegal immigration at their end. Another part of it was, if the ships were damaged, who's going to claim responsibility for this? So an Arab organisation is invented, Arab Friends of Palestine, which wrote letters claiming responsibility for the sabotage. And these are posted, typed on French typewriters and other continental typewriters, posted on the continent to the Prime Minister, to the Foreign Secretary. So MI6 is writing letters on behalf of someone else to its own government, claiming responsibility for this. Now, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary knew about it. They knew about it. But the guys in their office receiving these letters certainly didn't know about it and weren't about to be told. So there's another thing. And if the frogmen and the yachts were caught, they were told to say they were working for an American organisation with oil money behind it, an anti-communist one who wanted to stop, because on the grounds that the Jews going to Palestine, A, were going to annoy the Arabs, and that might interfere with oil. Is there an echo here of some more recent kinds of motivations? Right. And also that they were all communists anyway. So it's a wonderfully many-layered thing. But one of the ships, if I may just finish with this, that they were going to disable but didn't, was a ship called the President Warfield. And the President Warfield was in a French port, and at the last moment the guys were pulled off this and said, the French will sort this out. As it happens, the French didn't. This ship sailed, and it became the Exodus, the most famous of all these refugee ships. And when it got to Palestine, it's intercepted by the British Navy. Two or three people are killed. They poor, desperate people are sent all the way back to Europe, and it's a public relations disaster. And MI6 said afterwards, if we'd been able to disable this before it left, you'd have been saved all that bother, and those lives might not have been lost. So what's the success or failure?
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We have an email here from Maury Schaffner, who writes to us from Florida, saying, I find extraordinarily interesting the real history of spy agencies. I would like to know what the author thinks about John le Carré novels, since when I personally think of spies, those novels come to mind and not the James Bond films, which I have to say I like as very funny fantasies. Do you agree? Keith?
Oh, yes, sorry. I'm just reading Le Carré's new novel, and it's absolutely terrific. No, I shouldn't be here selling someone else's book. But it's both and, not either or. Yes, I think Le Carré, who, of course, himself was a member of the service, and he does give an extraordinary, vivid picture of how it was in the 50s and 60s. I mean, the early novels are particularly resonant, and it's just that early period which I move into. And I think, yes, if you want something more of the real flavour of how it was in those, you know, dark, difficult, suspicion-filled Cold War years, I think Le Carré is very good at that. But again, because it's a novel, because he's essentially, I mean, the sort of fictional truth, making it up, it is more vivid, perhaps, than the actual reality.
We will have more of our conversation with Keith Jeffrey. He's a professor of British history at Queen's University Belfast. He has written many books. The latest is The Secret History of MI6 1909 to 1949. We'll be taking more of your questions and comments after this short break. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. If you have questions for Keith Jeffrey, give us a call.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by EarthShare, whose member organizations work for a clean, healthy, sustainable environment. One environment, one simple way to care for it. EarthShare.org. This is NPR.
Economist Robert Reich says we won't see a real recovery until we change laws that are making the rich richer and robbing the middle class of the spending power that could restart a stalled economy. His new book is called Aftershock. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Reich. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined by Keith Jeffrey. He is the author of The Secret History of MI6, 1909 to 1949. We'll be taking more of your questions and comments. The phone number is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. I wanted to read an email to you, a question that comes to us from Dee, Keith, who writes, "My question is, how deep were they spying on Germany during World War II, and were they concerned about some of the members of the royal family's German connection?"
Germany is a very difficult target in the Second World War. And in fact, most of the information that's coming out of Germany tends to be either gossip or from some gossip from people close to the Nazi top brass reporting some of this coming through Bucharest, in fact, in the Balkans. And also reports of visitors like Swedes who are able to travel through and report back on the damage of the aerial bombing campaign. But really, Germany is a very, very hard nut to crack. And even towards the end of the war, when you're sending in agents in 1945, early 45, they reckon that the life of an agent in Germany is about 3 weeks. So it's really, really a problem. As for the royal family, there's not really much interest about that, because the royal family are very important and everyone's interested in them in a kind of decorative way. But frankly, they're irrelevant to the war effort. And that's why the Duke of Windsor is sent off to the West Indies, where he's out of trouble. Within Britain, some of the Nazi sympathisers or people who are close to this are rounded up by MI5, and they give no trouble at all. So there's really very little of that sort of thing that is of concern to Six.
Let's go to Robert in Tavares, Florida. Robert, you have a question for Keith Jeffrey.
Good morning, Kathy. Thanks.
Good morning.
Mr. Jeffrey, that's a fascinating book. We're looking forward to reading that. I have a question for you. To what extent were the British intelligence involved with Operation Paperclip? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Keith.
Well, what MI6 provide for you know, all these various operations and the disinformation ones as well, is they provide...
First of all, Keith, tell us a little bit about Operation Paperclip.
I think Robert will tell us what he thinks about Operation Paperclip, so we're talking about the same operation.
Robert's taking his answer off the air, so you fill us in.
Right, well, I have... Well, Paperclip isn't an MI6 operation. I mean, I'll talk about some of these other ones. But where there's a overseas dimension in running things through neutral Spain and Iberia, for example, MI6 provides that backup. As for the specific Operation Paperclip, you're going to have to look elsewhere than my book, I'm afraid.
Okay, there's an email that comes to us from Alice in Frederick, Maryland. Alice writes, in books and films, one always encounters gadgets. In your research, did you see evidence of such gadgets? And if so, what were a couple of the most unusual or interesting? Thank you, Alice. That's a very interesting question.
Well, from the beginning, gadgets and sort of technological backup is absolutely essential. And the first chief of the service is a techno geek who loves this kind of stuff and disguise and what have you. One of the things they're urgently interested in is secret writing, invisible ink, right from the beginning. And they employ a scientist who's a fellow of the Royal Society, he's a very distinguished scientist, who has a recipe for invisible ink, which I've put in the book. Another discovery, though, they find is that apparently semen makes a very useful and usable invisible ink, which pleased greatly the chief of the service at the time, but was perhaps less welcome news to the people who had to use it out there. Then there are concealing devices. There's an interesting story from the Second World War of a false horse penis being used in Italy to smuggle documents through enemy checkpoints of one sort or another. You could also put over, you could shave a sheep, put the documents on the sheep, and then put your fleece back over it to move things that
all
way.
Of course, in the interest of protecting the realm.
Oh, precisely. That's right. And then communications. I mean, that's utterly fundamental and important to this. And we assume that you can, use a cell phone to ring Australia, call Australia, you know, any time of the day or night. No, in fact, the suitcase radio is the cutting edge of technology, really important during the Second World War, and an enormous advance on previous possibilities. It looks pretty primitive to us. It was jolly important then.
Let's go to Najid in Cincinnati, Ohio. Najid, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, I'm right here.
Yes, you have a question for Keith Jeffrey.
That's right. Yeah, Professor Jeffrey, thank you very much for the opportunity. I had a question for you. One is, I'm sure you're aware of Operation Mockingbird here in the U.S. by the CIA.
No, tell me about it.
It was basically that several... probably dozens, maybe even more than that, authors, reporters were planted at some of the most important media outlets in the U.S. to basically, manipulate the news or flower up the news for the government's agenda. Were there similar operations in Britain under the the authority of MI6, and are such operations still in effect in Britain?
Yes. Well, I can't possibly comment about the contemporary thing. But yes, a similar operation was run by MI6 targeting the United States in the Second World War. William Stevenson, a Canadian, ran the MI6 operation in North America during the Second World War out of the Rockefeller Building in Manhattan. And one of the things he had to do was to manipulate propaganda. And he ran a radio station which is ostensibly independent, but it was pushing out pro-British, pro-Allied, anti-German propaganda. They got tame journalists, yes, to report it as well. So absolutely, that's part of the covert manipulation of information which an organisation like this can do. Yes.
Keith, we talked a little bit before the break about Operation Embarrass, where the British Secret Service was employed to try and stop Jews from reaching what was then Palestine. But you also write in the book that the head of the MI6 station in Berlin before the Second World War actually saved a lot of Jews. What was that story?
Yeah. The head of station in Berlin was a heroic figure called Frank Foley, very, very good intelligence officer. And the cover that British MI6 officers had mostly across the world was as passport control officers. So these were the guys in the British embassies and consulates, wherever they might be, giving visas for people wanting to come to Britain. And of course, by doing that, they were licensed to inquire about the people. So they had an intelligence gathering, overt intelligence gathering function. But as the 1930s progressed, as the persecution of Jews tightens and increases, particularly in Germany, those visa control mechanisms, those passport control officers come under increasing pressure. And Frank Foley assists many thousands of Jews to leave Germany in those desperate, terrible years running up to the Second World War. And he is a sort of righteous Gentile. He's a hero in the history of the Jewish thing. So, you know,
and did he run into problems with headquarters for doing that, or was that sanctioned his activities?
No, he pushed the limits as far as he could go, and he got some criticism from home for being a little bit too generous with handing out the visas, because it was a very, very difficult period. And you find that there were people at the London end who didn't want just to open the doors completely, because people didn't realise what the alternative was. I mean, the actual threat under which Jews lay during the Second World War was imperfectly perceived in Germany, let alone in Britain, and that might have been one of the failures of British intelligence at the time, though Foley knew full well what the kinds of dangers were.
How long did MI6 manage to keep agents? You mentioned earlier that it was the lifespan towards the end of the war was reckoned to be only 3 weeks for a British or a foreign agent operating in Berlin. But how long at the beginning of the war did we manage to keep MI6 agents operative in the country, inside Germany?
MI6 had a very bad start to the war. I mean, like most of the rest, the British sort of defence security machine, after all. There are no high-level
agents. Because they weren't prepared, or why was it such a rocky beginning?
It's a combination of the seriousness and the difficulty of the operating environment in Germany. I mean, the German security agencies are very, very good. And when, for example, they try to pick up information about concentration camps just before the war, they find a guy in Switzerland and he says, well, I might be able to tell you something, but nobody wants to speak about it because they're afraid of being betrayed, and even talking to the British is going to make life more dangerous. So that was one thing. The other thing is that the British never really worked in the same way as the Soviets in planting long-term penetration agents. Now, this had a great catastrophic result on the British end with people like Kim Philby. But the British practice, perhaps a bit too late to appreciate the full dangers of Nazi Germany, but they weren't, as it were, planting agents in the 1920s and early 1930s who could then reach the top and pay off. So that was perhaps an error.
I've got a couple of questions here who've come in, Keith, about Sidney Riley. Christopher writes to us, I greatly enjoyed the BBC series Riley Ace of Spies on Sidney Riley, the first British super spy. Was he still active after 1909? And did he work for MI6 in the early days? And Donald writes to us, how dominant... this is not a question, but how, no, Margaret writes to us, starting in 1909, with British worries about the Kaiser's fleet building, do you cover the work of Sidney Riley?
Yes. Well, Riley has this reputation, the Ace of Spies, and he was a very, very able man, a man with an Irish name, but certainly not an Irish background. He was a completely invented figure who came out of the kind of Eastern European background. And he is employed at an early stage after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 to penetrate Russia. And he has quite good contacts, and he produces some really good information, both from South Russia, because he starts off working for MI1C, as it was then, as the predecessor of MI6, in the sort of Crimea and Caucasus area, and later further north in Petrograd or St. Petersburg, as it's now known. But Riley is a crucial object lesson of a spy, an intelligence gatherer who dabbles in politics. And he saw it as his job. One of the reasons he worked for the British is he wanted to bring down the Soviet regime. He was, you know, fierce anti-Bolshevik. But he began working to that end. So not just gathering intelligence, but also dabbling in internal Russian politics and doing more than his brief was from MI6. And that conjunction of a kind of special operations and political obsession with him. Maybe correct, maybe not, but that combination proved fatal for him in the end, because it enabled the Soviets to lure him to his death in 1925. So he becomes less valuable as a spy the more he becomes a kind of anti-Bolshevik activist.
I'm Katty Kay of BBC World News America, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to Kevin, who is calling us from Washington, D.C. Kevin.
Hi, good morning. I had the pleasure of meeting Keith Jeffrey at a conference in Belfast last summer on the Churchills in Ireland. And I was going to ask a question about Churchill and his approach or his attitude towards MI6. This creation of the Special Operations Executive and the competition between the two. But he brought up the Cambridge spy ring, and I'd really like to ask, what was he able to find out about the damage that Burgess and McLean and Philby did to MI6?
Okay, well, Kevin, great to hear from you. I mean, Churchill's very important. He's in love with intelligence. He likes the raw material. He likes the stuff. And he certainly makes it a priority when he becomes Prime Minister. But he figures right from the beginning of the history of the organisation. As for the Cambridge spy ring, Philby, of course, is the key man here. Now, I stop at the end of 1949, and I'm not supposed to know anything that happened after that. But I could not write about Philby as he was on the 31st of December 1949, trusted, valued, able, you know, at the centre, in the highest management level, towards the highest management level of the organisation. I had to use the benefit of hindsight. And when you have that, and you know that he's a bad un, and he's reporting stuff to the Soviet Union, it puts an extraordinary resonance on the documents which you read. And you find, for example, in 1945, when the Corby case pops up in Canada, where a cipher clerk defects from the Soviet embassy and says there are atom spies, particularly fingering a guy called Alan Nunn May, who's an Englishman. And it comes back to Philby in the headquarters of MI6 in London. He's in charge of security. Ha! Yes, very good, doing this. And you can see Philby's footprints across this process, trying to blunt the British response to this, trying to make sure that a less able interrogator is sent out to North America, trying to keep the politicians out of it. And you only know this really with the benefit of hindsight. He was MI6's worst traitor, and you know, it's an extraordinary story, which happily I was able to tell from the inside.
So even then, you can look back and see where he was trying to dupe his superiors.
Very much so, very much so. There's another extraordinary moment when there's a communist sympathiser who's working for the organisation and communists worked for it in the Second World War. The Russians were, after all, allies then. But he wants to leave the organisation in 1944 and go back to being a journalist, or just at the end of the war, 44, 45. And it goes again to Philby. Is he a communist agent? And Philby writes this note saying he's got very dangerous and suspicious friends, but I think we may be confident he's not a communist agent, because having got into the organisation, having got his feet under the table, as it were, the Soviets would not ever have let him leave. Now, Philby would know, wouldn't he?
He would have known. Keith, before we go, I just want a quick description. We've been talking about the history of MI6, of course. What's the organisation like today?
They're extraordinarily generous to an independent historian who's let in to look at its archives over the first 40 years, and I thank them for that.
And are they operating the same as they always have?
I hope they're
thriving.
I hope they're thriving, because they do important work of national importance. But it is also important that they're accountable. And really, allowing people to write their history and to look independently at their history is a measure of that accountability. And I think that's important too.
Keith Jeffrey is Professor of British History at Queen's University, Belfast. His new book is The Secret History of MI6, 1909 to 1949. Keith Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Katty Kay, filling in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening today.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.